The Holy Gospel according to St. Luke, the 6th chapter. Jesus said, "But I say to you that listen, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from anyone who takes away your coat, do not withhold even your shirt. Give to everyone who begs from you. And if anyone takes away your goods, do not ask for them again. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you hope to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love your enemies, do good, and lend, expecting nothing in return. Your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. For the measure you give will be the measure you get back." The Gospel of the Lord. Please be seated. Now may the words of my mouth and the meditations upon each of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. We continue today with our review of 1 Corinthians. Saul of Tarsus, later renamed St. Paul. Saul of Tarsus was a triple threat. Number one, he was a Roman citizen, which meant that he could travel from the British Isles all the way down to the Red Sea using one currency with unprecedented legal protection. And all he had to say was, "Civis Romanus sum," I am a Roman citizen, and doors would open for him. Number two, Tarsus is just down the coast of Turkey from Greece. And so he was conversant and trained in the best of Greek logic, rhetoric, thought, and philosophy. Number three, when he was young, he traveled to Jerusalem and studied with one of the best Pharisees, a man named Gamaliel, and he earned the nickname a Hebrew of the Hebrews, a triple threat, Roman, Greek, and Jewish. If he were alive today, St. Paul would be the immaculately dressed traveler that you see in an airport business lounge. His passport is full of stamps from all over the world. He's fluent in half a dozen languages. He's checking his smartphone for the latest updates from Tokyo while he's waiting for the private jet that will take him from Davos to Johannesburg by way of a speaking engagement in Melbourne. For a young institution such as the Christian Church, Saul of Tarsus, he was the sort of mover and shaker who would be either your greatest asset or your worst nightmare. And we've all heard the story of his conversion. If you look in the southeast corner of our gallery, we have a stained glass window dedicated to St. Paul. And in the background of the window, sure enough, you see the road stretching off to distance, the road to Damascus, where he experienced his conversion. From there, St. Paul went from being the church's nightmare to its greatest writer. He was educated. He was a man of letters. He made his mark on Christianity in the world by writing words, 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 so many words. If you tally them up, approximately 25% of all the words in the New Testament are from St. Paul. And here we are at the end of Paul's first letter to the church at Corinth, 15 chapters in, and he's still going. And this is good news, because the church of Corinth needed a good tongue lashing at this point, and St. Paul was just the man to do it. If you had to describe the church at Corinth, if you had to describe the Corinthians in a single word, they were sophomoric. Sophomoric, your vocabulary lesson for today. Sophomoric comes from two Greek words. The first is sophos, meaning wisdom, wise. The second is moros, which gives us our English word morons. It's right there in verse 36. In our translation here in the bulletin, Paul calls them foolish, but he actually uses the word moros, you morons. The Corinthians were not just morons. They were the most dangerous type of morons imaginable. They were morons who thought of themselves as wise. Quick show of hands, has anyone run into someone like that? Thus far, Paul has gone after the morons in Corinth over worship, over Holy Communion, over keeping kosher, over how to be the church. And here in the penultimate chapter in his letter, he goes after the morons for perhaps the biggest topic of all, and that is the resurrection of the body. You say this word every week in the creed, I believe in blah, 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 I believe in the resurrection of the body. Up to this point, the Corinthian morons, that was going to be the alternate title of this sermon, but we thought it was too much for the sign outside. The Corinthian morons have been poking fun at the idea of bodily resurrection. Because if everybody in history comes back from the dead, how are we going to have room for everyone? Just think of the logistics of it. We have enough trouble keeping one toilet functioning in this church. What's going to happen when everybody comes back and needs to find a place to do number two? This is silliness, and you are correct to laugh, but it's dangerous silliness. It is foolish wisdom. The Corinthian morons were trying to describe immortality after the resurrection using concrete images of mortality before the resurrection. Trying to describe immortality after the resurrection with concrete mortality before the resurrection. This has been a hallmark of false religion for centuries. It does not matter if you are talking about pearly gates and clouds and harps, or if you're talking about 72 dark-eyed virgins and the perpetual erection of the faithful. Trying to describe immortality after the resurrection using images of mortality before the resurrection is a recipe for disaster. But that's exactly what the Corinthian morons have done. They have set up a false vision of heaven. It's a classic straw man in which life after the resurrection is just like it is right now, where everybody who has ever lived, everybody who's alive today, everybody who will ever live, will come back to eat, drink, have sex, play cards, and cheer for the New England Patriots forever. And the morons reject this straw man as ridiculous, correctly, because it is ridiculous, except for the part about the Patriots. But they further conclude that because their stupid ideas about the resurrection are stupid, therefore there can be no resurrection. Because my stupid ideas about the resurrection are stupid, therefore there is no resurrection. And so Paul walks them through it, gently, and sometimes not so gently, pointing out that the Corinthian morons are not nearly as smart as they think themselves to be. What the Corinthian morons didn't get is that God's work in this world has direction to it. And that direction is pointed towards transformation. Martin Luther said it this way: what good would God have accomplished if things would not be different, if man would always have to bear his paunch and sack of stench with him, and eternally stuff himself and eliminate, discharge mucus, rot, be lazy, and be ill? And why should we proclaim this, believe, and suffer if we could hope for nothing better? So Paul walks them through the analogy of scattering seeds on the ground. We're just a few weeks away from spring. Those of you with red maple trees in your yard, what happens every spring? All the little helicopters come spinning down to land on the ground. All else being equal, each of those little helicopters is designed to hit the ground and sprout into a tree. That maple spinner is not the same thing as a maple tree, but it has direction where it will become a maple tree. Focus on what Paul says in verse 47. The first man was from the earth, a man of dust. The second man is from heaven. Strip that down to its barest essentials. Blah, 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 blah. First, blah, 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 blah. Second. First to second. Paul is describing a progression, movement from point A to point B. This is a story with a once upon a time and a happily ever after. It's drama. This is one of the greatest gifts the Greeks have given us, apart from philosophy, is drama. The idea of conflict, development, resolution. It's like a piece of music. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that sounds trivial, but just think about that for a second. A beginning, a middle, and an end. It's easy for us to take it for granted. But Western music owes a tremendous debt to the Greeks and their ideas about drama and narrative. The very fact that music exists for us as a piece, which has a beginning, a middle, and an end, that's not a given elsewhere in the world. Non-Western music is not always like that. Outside of Western traditions, music exists as this sort of unbroken continuum where it just sort of goes and you can sort of walk in and walk out at any time. There is no clear beginning or end to it. That may be lovely, but it doesn't operate with this same sense of Greek drama or narrative of beginning, middle, and end, and direction that goes from one to the other. And so Paul, Greek to the core, this sense of directionality is paramount. He's speaking of firsts that must progress into seconds. He's speaking of something that will experience a transformation, that will become a new version of itself. The same way that an acorn sprouts into an oak tree. The acorn is not the same thing as the oak tree. The oak is different from the acorn, but both are part of a trajectory. Paul is talking about something that comes before, which must lead into something that comes after. He's talking about dissonance that must resolve into consonant harmony. Listen to how many times he speaks in the future tense, just in this one chapter. Verse 22, "For as in Adam all die, so in Christ all will be made alive." Verse 49, "Just as we have borne the image of the earthly man, so shall we bear the image of the heavenly man." Verse 51, "Listen, I tell you a mystery. We will not all sleep, but we will all be changed." Verse 52, "The trumpet will sound. The dead will be raised imperishable, and we will be changed." Paul emphasizes that things will be different. There is a transformation which will take place, that all of the dissonant harmonies of the world today will find a consonant resolution. Future tense, future tense, future tense, but the Corinthian morons were having trouble with this because they could only appreciate this one little snapshot of right now. That disconnect between what will be, future tense, and what is and what has been, past tense and present tense, that was hard enough for the Corinthian morons, and it's difficult enough for us too today. But it gets worse. All of those times that God writes in the future tense, guess what? There is no future tense with God. There is no future tense with God. In God's eye, all of the shall be's and will be's that Paul describes, these are already done's, already is. God is eternal. He exists above time. We say that he is the Alpha and the Omega. He is the once upon a time and the happily ever after, all at the same time. In his eternal eye, there is no before, no now, no yet to be, because God supersedes time. We can appreciate this tiny little speck of right now. We can look back and we can remember what was, and if we really put our heads together and try really hard, we might be able to make some halfway decent projections about what's coming down the pike. But to God in eternity, it's all there. That's why the reading last week spent so much time and effort on the all or nothing nature of the resurrection. Because for an eternal God, it can't be a wait and see and maybe it's true or not proposition. No, either it is a take it to the bank certainty, or it is foolishness, and those Corinthian morons were right to make fun of it. The good news is this: the resurrection is real. You can say it in the past tense, that the resurrection happened. You can say it in the present tense, that the resurrection is here right now. You can say it in the future tense, that the resurrection will happen. The limitations of human language and understanding are going to make a mess of it no matter what. The essential point is this: the resurrection is real. It happened before you were born, when Christ put an end to death. We've got this beautiful mural right behind me for that. It happens today every time we bring a child up to the baptismal font for the sacrament of baptism. Someone born into slavery of sin, and God looks down on that child and says, "No, this one is mine. This is not a slave to sin. Never was, never will be. This one is mine." And the resurrection sits way out there at the end of days, when all the walls will come a-tumbling down, as the song goes. The question for you today is now, what are you going to do about this? Today, right now, how are you going to live your lives with the sure knowledge that all of us were slash are slash will be, take your pick, transformed in the twinkling of an eye? Because we do indeed live in the present. All of you are eventually going to walk out those doors, and you have choices to make today. How are you going to live as people confident that God is at work in the world? Gospel reading in your bulletin is probably a good place to start. Love your enemies. Love your enemies. Not because they're lovable, because they aren't, and guess what? Neither are you. Neither am I. Neither is Pastor Tim or Tasha. Pastor Adam is kind of lovable, but his cats are not. Love your enemies because every single one of them is valued in God's sight. God has prepared a place for them in the resurrection. He looks past what they are right now. He looks past what you are right now. He looks past what you did yesterday. He looks past what they did yesterday. And he's looking past all of the many ways that you and everyone around you is guaranteed to make an absolute dog's breakfast of it tomorrow. Love your enemies. God sees what you and your enemies are to become. The same way that a farmer sees past the seeds falling on the ground, and he sees all the way out to harvest time. Do good to those who hate you. Not because it wins you points with God, or because you're magically going to turn haters into lovers just by holding the door for them or yielding the right of way out on Route 30. You probably won't, and that's okay. Do good to those who hate you regardless, because there is no distinction to be made between people who hate you and people who love you. Every single one of them is a freed soul purchased by the sacrifice of Christ. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other cheek. And from anyone who takes your coat, don't withhold your shirt. This is why, way back in the first chapter of this letter, this is 15 chapters ago at this point, Paul started out his letter to the Corinthian morons by saying that the message of the cross is foolishness, or the message of the cross is moronic to those who are perishing. Turn the other cheek? Give away my shirt? Really? Do good to those who hate me? It sounds kind of foolish, doesn't it? It's not. It is seeing the world through the knowledge that God is at work. It is living in the middle of dissonance, as if you know that harmony, consonance, and resolution are just around the corner. Thanks be to God, and amen.